Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Journey to Success Radio Network. Our purpose on Journey to Success Radio is to interview and promote people making a positive difference in this world with their lives. My name's Tom Tuttle Cunningham. I'm a motivational speaker, helping people to live positively with and through the many and varied challenges of life. I've had rheumatoid arthritis from my jaw to my toes since the age of 5. That's 45 years now, and in that time I've had 4 hips, 4 knees, and 2 shoulders replaced, and I've been hospitalized about 40 times. I also stand about 5'1", and that's due to the heavy daily doses of the oral steroid prednisone that I took to fight my arthritis. And, of course, anyone who knows me knows that despite those physical challenges, I always answer amazing when asked how I am doing. You can find out more about me at my website. It's Tom, the number 2, and tall.com. My guest today is the amazing Krish Dunham. Krish was born in South India, where he completed his early education. And after earning an MBA, he migrated to America in 1986. He won a sales contest in 1990, and that earned him a ticket to a seminar conducted by my favorite of all time, the legendary motivator Zig Ziglar. And this chance encounter would be the catalyst that shaped the next 2 decades as Chris joined the Ziglar Corporation in 1991 as a telemarketer and eventually became their vice president of global operations. Through training, teaching, and facilitating seminars all over the world, Krish launched his professional speaking career as one of only 2 executive coaches personally trained by Zig Ziglar. Krish has successfully delivered his message of hope, humor, and balance in over 50 countries and throughout the continental United States. His client list is the who's who of global enterprise, and he's received accolades from some of the most distinguished organizations, including the United States Army, Christian Dior, Toshiba, Hitachi, and many. He's the co-founder of a training company, managing partner in a seminar company, and author of The American Dream from an Indian Heart, and contributing author to the book Top Performance, written by Zig Ziglar. Welcome to the show today, Krish.
Thank you so much for having me, Tom. Appreciate it.
I have heard, as anyone who is a huge fan of Zig Ziglar has heard or read your name. You seem to have developed an unusual and lasting, long-standing relationship with Zig. He spoke about you often, and so what a great blessing. Tell us, let's start by talking about what was the influence of Zig Ziglar in your life, because obviously you influenced him as well, because as I said, he did write about you and speak about you fairly often.
Well, we lost him about a year ago, so speaking not in past, because his influence in my life has always been present, continuous. He was my spiritual father, a mentor to me in many different ways, but to sum it up, he was the most consistent man I've ever met, and having been grown up in an environment like India, to have a man of his wisdom and caliber embrace me when I was at the lowest ebb of my professional endeavors spoke volumes about his desire to lift humanity up true to his own calling. And so I was blessed to have been his associate, where I've sold books and tapes at the back of the room, which is nothing. It's a grandiose way of saying that I had the privilege of sitting next to him on a plane for 17 years and got a firsthand education that would happen after the seminars and before the next one.
Wow, and that's quite a blessing to have that one-on-one time. And it also appeared that Zig really took you under his wing. He had a soft spot in his heart for you.
Well, Mr. Ziglar, this morning, actually, I posted something. I remember asking him one time, I said, Mr. Z, when is a mentoring role complete, in the sense that when does the student know he's ready to teach? And Mr. Z's response, ever wise, always compassionate, was, if you're asking the question, that means you're not ready. And he just wanted it to be an ongoing relationship, and his his wisdom was just that. It was poignant and it was pointed at the same time. When I made a mistake that required a cajoling or a correction of some sort, he would do it by saying, "Krish, now is not the time because we are fresh in the incident, but remind me 3 or 4 days down the road that there's a lesson here that you need to learn," which means he would let me stew in it, but make sure that the onus of finding the solution lay upon me, and I would lament for 4 days feeling I disappointed him, so it would be I'd wait the 4 days and couldn't wait to ask him what I needed to do. And so that was, he was very unique in that attribute.
Wow, and that, as you said, also, what a great way to teach. It gave you a few days with ideas and solutions on your own as well. And so
formatting
a little bit of
the question to him, formatting the question to him was more important than the answer he gave you. Because of his status, because of his position, because of his visibility and persona, most people who walked up to him never coherently put together what they wanted from him. It was always platitudes of, you know who you are, you've inspired me, I've read all your stuff, I know you by heart and all that.
Yeah.
And that was stuff that he got while shaking hands in line. But if you wanted to cut through the point and get what you think he had for you, you had to posit the question in a way that nobody else was doing in a generic way. And I think that's what his message to me was. He says, if you don't want to be one of the crowd asking me stuff or just telling me stuff, write your question down in a unique way that would be something I'd never heard that day.
Wow, and that's a lesson in itself. Learn to ask original questions.
Absolutely. So I would, on flights, I would sit next to him knowing his routine by heart, that the only chance I got to ask him a question would be the last 15 minutes when he was done working. So I would write on the barf bag, on the napkin, whatever, I'd rewrite my question. So when it was my chance, I'd ask a poignant one. So.
Now, one thing that that stood out to me when I read your bio is that Zig only coached two people to be executive coaches. One thing that ran through my mind was, who was the other one?
Well, Brian Flanagan and me were
the
two people that had been...
Brian Flanagan.
Yeah, when the Speakers Bureau and all that went through a challenging and a changing time in the late 90s, early 2000, when they went the independent contractor route, only two people were retained in some sort of way. Brian was groomed and known, you know, to be the sales heir, so to speak, and I was taken under his wing for the motivation. So that was the moniker the organization themselves used in our early marketing. And when you look at his lasting legacy and the impact globally, I thought, man, if I don't attach myself to many things in this world that is splendor, that is a cool thing to attach yourself to.
And when I read your bio, I thought that was the most cool thing, personally trained by Zig. Now, the coaching to be an executive coach, was it different than what the public heard as far as from the stage and messages that he delivered?
Yeah.
What was different about being an executive coach?
I think the difference in a broader sense, whether it was with Mr. Ziglar or not, in a broader sense, an executive coach is someone who specializes in the why. Traditional coaching, you give them the how. You tell them how to do certain things. There's discipline, there's embodiment, there's sales, there's marketing, there's motivation, whatever it is, but there's a how-to culture that we live in. As you grow up the ranks and get to that executive level, the C-suite level, when you know why, anyhow begins to do. So you're not stuck with one formula because you understand the formula. And so the why becomes more important than the how, which means you're more philosophical in nature. You want to win in all areas of life. Every equation is value-based and not just activity-based.
Wow, that is a distinction I've never heard before, but so true. So much of coaching is how to do this, whereas when you get to those levels, you know how. That's why you got to that level. But if you know why, as you said, now you can use, if you have the big why or the why, then there are different strategies for the how. If you know,
I mean, growing up, all of us had, some of us at least had academic struggles. I know I did. And quantitative analytics and all that comes easier to my son. It was very difficult for me. Well, I grew up in a culture where they didn't really care how you got the answer. It was academic. They wanted you to get the answer. So you figured out a way to get it, but they never they never focused on the formula, which was the why. Once you know why, the formula, then math becomes easy, science becomes easy. So my son, basically, you know, he grew up in a culture where they specify the why when they teach them the formula. I grew up in one that didn't. And therein lies the difference, you know. Academics comes easy to those that know why and is a little harder for those who only try to find out how.
Exactly. Now, as you may know, Toronto is the most multicultural city in the world. We have,
sure.
And where I live in Brampton, it's known as the India of Toronto. All my neighbors are Indian.
Sure.
Tell us about your upbringing in India. What was that like? And then I've heard of maybe a handful of people that go to different countries with less than $10 in their pocket. And that mm-hmm. scares the heck out of me. I wouldn't even go to the next town with $10 in my pocket, let alone a whole new country. What was it like?
Well, before I go down that path, just hearing your intro and listening to your background and what you overcame with the rheumatoid arthritis and all the other stuff, I just want to let you know, sometimes it's easier going somewhere with $9 and then 3 weeks later you figured it out than to go to 45 years and still emerge. So you, my friend, are the one who has actually perfected long-term change. let me just give that to you as a shout out, because I'm quite amazed by what you've accomplished.
I love that point. When I first got married, my wife sometimes used to say, well, you're used to living in pain. And it took a number of explanations to let her know that, no, pain today is the same as pain 25 years ago, 45
sure.
years ago. It's still unpleasant and not fun
right.
to live with.
But
so, yeah, what was it like
growing up
in India?
I grew up in a family that, typical Indian, South Indian family. You know, my mother was a child bride, married to my dad somewhere around 14. Brother at 16 or 17, me a little shy of 20. So, you know, she stopped the eighth grade, and that was the mom who raised us.
Oh.
Father finished up his undergrads, had to study under street light to graduate from college. His parents couldn't afford electricity. So those were the humble
wow.
beginnings, but their emphasis was on education. Their emphasis was on being worldly. My father worked for an American company, so he had opportunity to see what the West had to offer, and groomed both my brother and I to do that. And so we were quite, from a very young age, were taught about a world that existed beyond that little hamlet. And so that was the desire to do that. Academics along the way, you know, some things were easier than others, some things were harder, because India is a comparative society. You're always compared to someone else's kid, so that stigma existed. Once we grew up, you know, it was tough. I'm not going to kid you, my father's, you know, family, extended family, he taking care of people, not having enough money left over. We dealt with all the issues that normal people deal with, but we had a family that respected each other, a lot of love in the home. My mom and my dad were just, you know, unbelievable in their love for each other. And this we saw. So one of the things my parents taught us as attributes for future living was, how do you treat your spouse? How do you treat others? All the good nature attributes. Now, I want to just complete the component of the story, which is more important than my own success, is at the age of 72, my mother did finish her master's. And at the age of 80, yeah, and at the age of 79, my father just began his PhD.
Wow.
So when my dad was asked the question, which may be the truth of our own survival, why are you doing this? He said, because I can. And when someone said, but you'll be 83 by the time you finish, his response was, how old will I be if I didn't? So I guess even though he was not a motivational speaker, I learned more from him in actions and perseverance than anybody else. And you fast forward that, the ambition to come to America, of course, exists in the heart of most people in different parts of the world, you know, the North American continent. You live in Canada. Large influx of Indian immigration comes into Canada. Canada and America are the two most popular destinations, and the United States are the two most popular destinations for people who can get out of India, either professionally, academically, or some way. So like everybody else, I set my sights. And my bride was born here but raised in India, so she allowed me through her citizenship by birth status to bring me over in 86. So, and that's the Reader's Digest version of a fairly otherwise long journey. You there? It cut off. Hello?
Oh, there. All right.
You there?
Hello there. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Can you hear me?
You got. Yeah.
Yeah.
You
your
got
parents
that?
Must have been nervous. Yeah.
Yeah, they were. And my dad's advice to me growing up was, I remember when I left for India, he said for every step, well, left for the U.S., he said for every step you take forward, I'll take one right behind you. God forbid you ever fall, I'll be right there to catch you. Don't be afraid to succeed.
Wow.
And sometimes
that
I think, Tom, you probably encounter this in your own journey through your own explanations as a speaker, but most of the times when people we consult with and counsel with, we find out that theirs is not a fear of failure. 9 times out of 10, it's a fear of success.
Yeah. Isn't that scary that people are afraid of success? But
yeah,
so
because
true.
you have to let go of the anchor to sail.
Right. Now, Chris, you claim to be an anthropological motivator. And I've seen the word, but I don't think I could give a precise definition, and I've never heard of anyone, a motivator, calling themselves an anthropological motivator. So can you explain that to me and others?
Sure. The human condition that we are all is part of a process. And while most motivation tends to be in the go get 'em, Charlie, get out of the now into the then and forget the when and all the other stuff, pie in the sky, great by and by, you know, we do a lot of platitudes. Anthropology yeah. has basically dictated through the watching the societal evolution of men, we begin to see that there are certain people who succeed and certain people who don't, and there's a reason for it. We're tridimensional as a species. We're mental, physical, and spiritual. As a result, those that participate with the IQ, which is your intelligence, your EQ, which is your emotion, and your SQ, which is your spirit, seem to have a better success rate when you go past over civilizations. When you go back, you know, John Dee Unwin, you know, Sex and the Culture, going all the way back to Greece and Mesopotamia, basically said that when debauchery enters a culture, when morality is redefined, within 4 generations that culture ceases to be a superpower. America herself is about 2.5 generations down that serious debacle post-Vietnam. So when you study the anthropology of humanity, you begin to realize that success has happened throughout the history of man, but there are certain attributes that have always defined it within the confines of where it happened. So I always try to connect the dots of human history. For example, in the 1828 Noah Webster Dictionary, the word optimism is listed, pessimism isn't. So it's probably more of a modern-day invention than we'd willing to admit.
Wow, the dictionary did not have pessimism in it?
Now, I have a copy of
Amazing.
The 1828 Noah Webster Dictionary, which Mr. Ziegler gave me. Yeah, the word pessimism isn't in there. The word optimism is. Now, there may have been other words for lack of motivation or whatever, but anthropology has also said that we have changed our word phraseology to be more inclusive of pain and more glamorizing of defeat than almost any other word phraseology.
Amen.
You know.
Amen.
Yeah, we've
so
created
true.
Labels for everything and not spent enough time creating nomenclature for things that do work. But that's called lowering the bar so that we can sound utopian, in the sense that one of my sayings is, I said, you know, any society that decides it's not going to legislate morality but wants to legislate utopia is bound to fail.
Yeah, exactly.
And that may sound like a mouthful, but, you know, we try to legislate all these magic wand theories of boundaryless living, and, you know, it's all sound like great cosmic sucking sound, but man was designed for boundaries.
Amen, exactly. And you can't legislate morality. That's a personal choice of people. And
if you look back through history, morality was what was legislated. Utopia was not.
Yes,
and
exactly.
If we find ourselves in this, for example, if you look at the Bible, Moses started with X number of laws, Isaiah went, brought it down to 13, and Christ brought it down to 2. But the reason for all these laws we have is because of the twisting of vocabulary. And Dr. Ravi Zacharias makes this point in one of his lectures when he talks about the fact that when an attorney was asked a question in a courtroom saying, "Were you ever alone with the defendant?" the witness was able to say no, even though the evidence pointed that he had been with that person. When questioned further, saying, "You're under oath," he says, "Well, technically, if I was with him, I was not alone."
Whoa.
So you can twist it to say whatever you want, and we spend all our time arguing the twist.
What a good answer, but a wrong one, obviously, in the court of law. But,
right, so that's
wow,
what I mean by
powerful.
Anthropological motivator. I point out the value continuum in humanity, look back through civilizations, right, wrong, yes, no, black, white, good, bad, that kind of stuff. So.
Wow. Now, your love of history, I know Zig loved history. He was a student of history. He loved it. He read it. He talked about it. Did that rub off on you, or was that
absolutely
part of your own?
He was the reason. One of the edicts he gave me as a yearly discipline was he asked me to annually read 4 biographies of game changers. Of the last couple of 100 years, 1,000 years, whatever. But he says, read 4 biographies, and if possible, make sure one of them is with a person you disagree with the outcome, just so that you're not prejudiced with worldview.
Wow. That sounds like Abraham Lincoln advice. The people that were against him were the people he hired to work for him.
So people ask me, unless you're not going to understand what Viktor Frankl meant in his Man's Search for Meaning and talking about the concentration camps at Dachau and Auschwitz and, you know, all of those places, if you don't read what Adolf Hitler's entire journey was. You have to look, the whole thing is, do not ever judge anything by its abuse. And so if you want to understand Christianity, we have to study the Crusades, because that was a dark part of Christianity. It's not something that was condoned by Christ, but it did happen. So when people throw it in your face, at least you sound worldly in the fact that you've studied both sides of the equation. So when I go to India and speak, I'm very cognizant of the fact that I need to know enough about pantheistic worldviews if I'm going to give an apologetic for my theistic one. You see what I'm saying? So.
Amen. Did you grow up as a Christian? Were your parents
Christians?
No.
Mrs. Ziegler led me to Christ in 1993.
Wow.
So I had gone to ask him to come to my son's baptism, because I thought, you know, they videotape baptisms, and if I had a famous person in my son's baptism, at least I'd have bragging rights at a boring party. And when I went to invite him to my son's baptism, he says, he was the only one who asked me a question no theologian or preacher asked me. He said, "Why do you want to send your son to some place you're not sure you're going?"
Whoa. You didn't go easy on you with that one.
No, so I have the great privilege, and of course he attended my baptism, but I had the privilege of being baptized a minute before my boy.
Wow, that's quite a day, both you and your boy together.
Right,
so
and it's actually 20 years ago this year, so that was 1993, so we did the 20 years
wow.
of it this year.
Now, your son's name is Nick, and you prefer to be known as a Nick's husband and Nick's dad.
Right.
And with all your accomplishments, those are a lot of accomplishments, why do you want to be known by as Anila's husband and Nick's dad?
Well, you know, most of the people I've had the privilege of sharing a stage with are not out there saying that they shared the stage with me, so I'm not going to give them the same luxury.
Right. I haven't seen anybody say I shared the stage with Chris.
At the end of the day, it boils down to what are the blessings and what are the choices? They were a blessing. Everything else was a choice. You know, Mary Crowley said you're free up until the moment of choice, then the choice controls you. So becoming a speaker, becoming an itinerant, becoming an evangelist, these were all choices, and God's blessed the endeavor. But the constant in that, the ones that were a blessing to begin, the ones that allow the house to exist. And Mr. Ziegler always used to say, you know, it's most people can have a house, but they can't have a home with laughter. They can have a bed, but they won't have a good night's sleep. Cherishing the things that money can't buy was something he imbibed in me from a very, very early stage. And I remember asking him in Minneapolis one time, I said, why is the loneliest place in the world a hotel room after the applause has died down? He said, because you're traveling everywhere and convincing yourself that what you do, you're doing for them. And you have to go further and further away. He says, if you change your identity to whatever you do, you're able to do because of them, then home is the source of knowledge, and you can then tell people when they ask you, where are you going? You say, I'm going home. I just have to stop off in Pittsburgh on the way.
That's a powerful idea. You mentioned Mary Crowley, and boy, obviously Zig has really wore off on you because that's one of his favorites. I was just thinking, aren't there
absolute
books in the library? Can you buy books now in this day and age of Mary Crowley still?
I don't know if you can. All I know is that he used her quote, and she was the one who founded Home Interiors and made it into $500 million empire in Dallas. And so I know he did some work when he was speaking for them. I used to go sell books and tapes for that organization. I never met her or any of that stuff, but since he spoke about her, that was one quote that liberated me quite a bit when I heard it first 20 years ago.
Wow, it is a powerful quote, and Zig did love to quote Mary Crowley, one of his favorite ladies, it seems like. Now, your book, you have another book other than The American Dream from an Indian Heart, Hard-Headed and Soft-Hearted. What is that about?
This is a leadership primer I wrote with the former president of Microsoft, Rick Belluzzo. This came out in August of this year, and by God's grace has received some amazing reviews. Tom Ziegler, who you've had on your show, has endorsed it quite well on his own blogs and all that. But what we did was I met Rick about 8 years ago, and Rick was a CEO, top-down president of Microsoft, executive VP at HP, chairman of Quantum. Came from a tech background, but, you know, is the son of an Italian immigrant father who was brought here after World War II as a prisoner of war. So when we went back one generation, we found a lot of similarity in our own parents and what their own struggles were. So when I met Rick about 8 years, 10 years ago on the road, we became friends. Very unlikely couple to become friends in the sense that this guy was, you know, from a very, very different background. And so as we started speaking on the Get Motivated stages around the country, we did 100 events together, and we'd just usually be one and two speaking. People were resonating to our message, and they liked the yin and the yang, the in and out of approach that we gave. So about a year ago, we decided to combine our thoughts, and hard-headed, soft-hearted is something he got from Dave Packard as advice, saying if you want to succeed in this world, you have to be both hard-headed, which is results rule, and soft-hearted, which means relationship-based. So we wrote the book Hard-Headed, Soft-Hearted Lessons from the Boardroom to the Break Room. He came up with 10 principles top-down. I came up with 10 principles bottom-up, and we call it a leadership primer, which a lot of people are enjoying the reading of it. So.
Wow, fantastic, and I love that idea of hard. I didn't understand the hard-headed part, but really that is results-oriented.
Yeah, and total engagement. Sometimes you have to tell people, you know, there's an old saying that Mr. Ziegler used to tell this, this guy was asked, how long have you been working there? He says, ever since they threatened to fire me. So sometimes you have to tell it like it is. And I've had bosses who have done it both ways. I've had bosses who looked at me and said, you know, you're not really going to make it in sales. You can close a door, leave alone a sale. And I've had bosses on the other end who said, hey, you know, your very presence energizes the crowd. So you begin to realize that rules without a relationship will always lead to rebellion. And gone are the days when you can be an either-or leader, saying I'm going to be a high D, I'm going to be motivated, gung-ho, aggressive, you know, or the other side, completely soft-hearted pizza party and nap time. The reality of a mixed world that we live in with people from all corners of the globe, multicultural teams, diverse in nature, we cannot be either or anymore in business. We have to be and also.
Wow. One question I think of, Krish, is that with the work, you must have to travel a lot, speak at different venues. How do you get a strong relationship with your wife and your son, Nick, traveling a lot? That's hard on a family, it must be.
It is, and, I used to have an affirmation with my boy. We now do it through text or through our Facebook messaging when we can. But the affirmation with my boy every night was, "You're mine and I love you, you're terrific and I'm proud of you." And he would try to repeat it as best he could as he grew up. With my bride, I try to make sure that I text her if I'm within the zone of texting, maybe 10, 15 times a day. Nothing urgent, nothing suggestive, just things saying, "Hey, you know what, thinking of you guys." But making sure that every conversation I have includes them, every picture it's just one of those things that by promoting them to be bigger than me, I put them on a pedestal, so not only will they not fall, I can't reach them to knock them off.
that's
it
great.
Takes,
and
it
Nick
takes
is
effort.
Still at home,
it's,
or you said he's at university?
He's at university.
Oh,
he's studying engineering at the university. But the interesting thing is, Tom, it takes effort. With my bride, she's the first voice I have to hear every morning, no matter where in the world I am, the last voice I have to hear at night. Otherwise, it is something where I do get a little troubled if I don't make that call. So there are times when I'm jet-lagged and I'll be in a hotel, and then I'll wake up at 2 and I'll make that call or send her a text or an email. It's just important to have that.
Wow.
As the old adage goes, someone said, "How often should you tell your wife you love her?" I said, "Before somebody else does. It's not complicated."
very good. And I like how you reach out like that, because otherwise I'm sure days could go. Those calls.
Yeah, and, I think my son wrote in one of his college essays, he says, my dad's, I think I'll paraphrase him, but he says, my dad's unending love for his creator and his unending love for my mother are two things I hope to imbibe in my own life. He says, if I can have that kind of faith and family, I should be okay. And, ultimately, it's not so much about what you do. It's whether your example is worthy of someone else looking at and saying, hey, you know what, that person seems to have simplified it. But the logic is always, as Mr. Z would put it, can you have it all? Mother Teresa said you need to know what all is before you can have it. Hello?
My ear keeps knocking the wrong button on my phone here. you
sorry.
Mentioned Ravi Zacharias earlier. I love Ravi. His preaching is so logical, powerful, emotional. Is that the church you attend?
No, Ravi is, of course, he's got a worldwide ministry, the Ravi Zacharias International Ministries, and I serve on the board of his India. He's got a separate ministry in India called Ravi Zacharias Life Focus Society. So I've done a lot of events with him in India, and then but he doesn't have a church. He's a worldwide apologist, travels all over the world. But they have a strong presence in Toronto. I think his Toronto head is a gentleman by the name of Dr. Andy Bannister. So.
Okay. Oh, I've heard of Andy Bannister.
Yeah.
Okay. So he's
Andy Robbie. Represents RZIM in Toronto. So.
Oh, neat. Okay. I love Ravi and his
And Ravi, I think, was
so
originally
good.
From Toronto, if I remember right. He probably lived in Toronto before he moved to Atlanta. So.
Oh, neat. Very good. Very good. What is next for you? It seems like you've accomplished a lot. And it would be hard to imagine that you'd want to accomplish more, but, of course, our job is not done until the Lord calls us home.
Well, right now it's a missional purpose. Next of what I do is I humbly call myself a corporate evangelist and a business philosopher. So I'm spending roughly 3-4 months a year traveling through India and Africa trying to share messages of hope and humor and balance, but trying to bring the faith-based component, the tri-dimensional living. So I think I've got one more book in me, which will be number 6, but that'll be a book on relationships that I hope to be able to write with my bride. But I'm going to use that. I'm only going to do that when I'm 30, because I think you have to be married 30 years before you can give marriage advice. Of course, in North America right now, if you've been married 5 years, you're an expert.
Yeah, you can give advice then.
Yeah.
Most of your friends won't have been that long.
Yeah, and then, plan is to probably travel a little bit. Now that the boy is off in college, my bride's accompanying me on a few trips here and there. So some more of the wonders of the world to be seen. And so I want to do some part of that. Most of what I do will include travel. So I'm going to assume that, I'd like to do some of that with her and take her to some parts of the world that God has allowed me to see and let her see it as well, because she sacrificed early on so I could.
Amen, amen. And that's a nice way to travel with your wife and even to some of the events. She can
sure
travel with you. Brag on your wife a bit. Did she work? Has she studied? What did she do while you were out traveling the world and working with Zig?
She was raising the boy. She ran the ministry when we began that. She started running the company when we began that, does all the accounting, the tax, all that stuff.
Oh.
But
is
a business graduate. When she quit to stay home with Nick when he was born, she was actually making more money than I was at that time. So, she made the bigger sacrifice. We both met in business school in India, so she's not only more qualified than I am, she probably was underappreciated in all those years I traveled, but volunteered in the school and teaches a large Bible study and, worked on many different endeavors. So that's one of the things. Even though she stayed at home, it was very hard to get a hold of her because she was always, in fact, one of the coolest things is when she turned 50, I guess I can let out her age. When she turned 50, a lot of our son's friends gave her a trophy, which was called World's Greatest Nick's Mom. And because she was the mom who was at home that all the other moms relied on while they worked. And, we chose not to. Financially, it was something that, we did struggle with that one income, but it was a decision we had made that it is better to have security in what little we have than uncertainty in a lot. And
right.
She was there to go to the schools, pick him up, to all his robotics competitions. She traveled everywhere, made sure the booster clubs. And so she was very active in the PTA and all that. So got to give her full credit.
And
if he is where he is, she did it.
And it's to have a mom like her in the neighborhood where, as you said, other neighborhood moms and parents could rely on when they're at work. Can you go check this, look at that, help with that? Can they come over after school? Those are like valuable people to have in your neighborhood.
Yeah, and the kids were always, our house always had one or two kids. It was just, it's one of those things. And our boy, was the first to get his driver's license and all the usual stuff, first to have a car. So it just became the hangout. And with the hangout comes a den mother, and she was that. So.
And it is a sacrifice when you have a business degree and you're earning good money and so many. Be coming to Canada at all, Krish, in the new year?
I was there earlier this year in a couple of places, but I don't know about next year. Right now there's nothing on the schedule, but I am getting ready to do a few things that are that we have not announced yet that are in the trial stages, and that would include Canada as part of the... I have a couple of invitations to come to Toronto, but these are ministry invitations. So when you get those, we try to add one or two more so that, you know, it's feasible for the ministry to send me somewhere for 3 or 4 days at a stretch. So.
Amen. Amen. Tell me, this lady I've communicated with for about 25 years, Lori Majors. Can you tell me about Lori? Lori remembers my name, even if it's a few years between emails or contacts. She remembers things about me. This must be an extraordinary woman.
Well, you know, it's I have the rare privilege of calling her mom. In my book, American Dream from an Indian Heart, I wrote, you know, she has been my American mom for as long as I can remember. Miss Lori and I had something unique in that we both went to the office early because I was running international ops. I'd get there at about 4:30 or 4:45 in the morning, and she'd show up at 5. So we were the only ones in the office till the others showed up at 8. But again, you know, there you see discipline and consistency and a person who had such a great heart and respect for Mr. Ziegler that it was one of those things that it baffles the mind to look at longevity of that. I think she has served him and that organization for now almost 35 years. So in this day and age, it's hard to find. But I always tell people that if the dictionary ever went pictorial, the picture next to Mr. Ziegler would have to be, I mean, the word consistency would have to have Mr. Z's picture, and the word loyalty would have to have Miss Lori's picture.
Wow. 5 a.m. she was at the office?
Yeah, and she still does go to the office at 5 a.m. if she's there. 5 to 3, I think, is when she works.
And if I remember,
because he would wake up around that time with an idea or a concept, and before email and all that, you know, the fax machines and the phones, and he was old school in so many ways that she would have to get the stuff ready, and then if Mr. Ziegler and I had to travel, I'd go to the office at 5 in the morning, she'd have the stuff ready for me, I'd pick it up, take it, go to his house, and then drive him to the airport.
Wow. And I think if I read on Facebook recently about her birthday, she's not a young lady to be going to the office still at 5 a.m., but it must be.
Yeah.
It's obviously a passion of hers. And Zig said she had, I think, the most amazing vocabulary that he ever heard.
Yeah, and I think one of the stories he tells is, you know, when they, quote-unquote, evaluated the key members of the staff. I mean, she's edited all my books. I know that for a fact, or proofread them to the degree that they were presentable to publishers who eventually picked them up. But, she's diligence personified in the sense that there is no task that would be left undone. And if there was a question to be asked so the task got done right away in its allotted time, she would ask the question, but also would remind you if you were the one holding up the task in a very gentle and polite way. Mr. Ziegler's catchphrase was, inspect what you expect. That was Miss Lori.
Well, I use that phrase a lot, inspect what you expect. So that would... You probably would never want to be have to be reminded by Lori Majors. Probably,
Someone's
heart.
Yeah, if you were, you were probably holding up something, and you know, in her mind, it was not her reputation; it was his reputation that mattered, and almost everything else that matters with the corporate reputation. So those are the things that are important. But that's what, you know, most of his organization had that success element around it. Most of the key figures. But 8 or 10 people there who pretty much whose names you hear all the time all can easily say in some way they have been there in excess of 20 years.
Yes, as you said, there's about 8 that I know, the Brian Flanagan and Tom and
Bert
yourself
Newman,
and Lori. And so, they've all been there so long that they know the heart of Zig. And that's when Zig passed, I had no fear of the upcoming years because I know that the people still there, like Lori, yourself, and Brian, and Tom, that they know the heart of Zig so well that company will go on forever, the same impact.
And someone asked me, you know, they said that, I said, while I lament, we were all fortunate, part of that inner circle, to have so many individual memories with him that though we will grieve, we will not run out of memories. He made it a point to make sure that each one of us had our own set of memories about him, his philosophy, his impact. You know, mine was global. I found information, examples from Russia to Philippines. Brian found it in sales cultures. Miss Lori found it in correspondence with people whose lives were impacted, who had to reach him through her. You know, Tom saw it in his father and the legacy he now has to carry on his shoulders, which are fairly broad. So, but Mr. Ziegler made it a point to make sure that all of us had our own moments of truth with him that would sustain us as we took this philosophy forward.
And you must have also got to spend a fair bit of time with the redhead.
I have. We, towards the last 5 or 6 years of Mr. Ziegler's life and career, Mrs. Ziegler did travel with us. We did a couple of trips overseas, Australia, Panama, Korea, Japan. And we were on those trips together. And then domestically, when we flew around to the different events, she would travel with us. So I did get to spend a considerable amount of time with her as well. And those, of course, you know, she was made so famous through the stories and through the speeches that wherever she went, she was a rock star. It was almost like people knew every attribute of her or some story about her. So it was fun to see her sign the books and, you know, so.
Yeah, her reputation would precede her for sure.
Absolutely. And it's, it's fascinating. It's fascinating to have watched that journey as well. So.
Wow. Did she travel with Zieg the last 5 years out of concern for Zieg? Because his health was not perfect the last 5 years. Chris?
You there?
Yep.
Hello?
Hello? Hello? Hello? You there, Chris? We've lost Chris, so his call fell. Thank you so much, Chris, for joining us today. What an amazing time to hear of Zieg Ziegler and your life with the Ziegler Organization. What a great blessing. Thanks so much, and have an amazing day.